Well, thank you for the introduction, and most importantly, thank you for having me today. In this presentation, I'm going to talk about an intriguing research project. Sometimes research really takes unexpected turns, and I think this is one. This research, I entitled this research, Cementing Roman Concrete to a Caldera. Why this title? Clearly, ancient concrete would seem to have nothing or little to do with volcano geology, but actually it does. In fact, Roman Connection was the running title that the journal Science gave to this research when we published, and in a nutshell, I'm going to say that the reason of this connection between volcanic rocks and concrete is that because the discovery that the cap rock, so the lead of this geothermal system that is called Phlegraean Field, is in southern Italy. I'm going to show where we are in a minute. So the cap rock of this system is made up of a fiber-reinforced rock that is formed by the mixture of lime-rich fluids with the local volcanic ash that is called pozzolana. As we will see, this is exactly the same recipe that Romans were used to make their famous concrete, and we will see why. In fact, these rocks share many physical properties with the Roman concrete, and probably it helps us understand both the physical chemical processes that may have in a caldera, and also understand why the rocks in this caldera are able to withstand such high strain and also strength, as we will see. Before entering into the details of this presentation, I like to cover some basics, some really basic concepts that will help us guide along the way. I will use a lot the terms pozzolan, pozzolanic ash, and sometimes the Italian term pozzolana. They refer to the same thing. And with the term pozzolan, this term indicates a siliceous or aluminum siliceous material that in presence of moisture or in presence of water reacts with lime to form cementitious compound. So this is a well-known type of reaction that is well known in the engineering community. And so by the mixture of volcanic ash or ash in general, or this siliceous, aluminum siliceous material with lime, that reaction forms a series of minerals that are called CASH, calcium aluminosilicate hydrates. This is a well-known property since Roman time. As I mentioned at the very beginning, Romans were used to mix lime with the volcanic ash from the same place that I'm going to focus the presentation today. So the place is, I did something wrong. I pressed the wrong button. I wanted just to have the pointer. So, okay, I go back. Okay. Yeah, okay, and so what's the pointer? Okay, sorry, thank you. This town, Puteoli, is the town I'm going to focus today. Roman time was the port of entry of, it was a famous harbor of the Roman Empire in Italy. And so this, as I mentioned earlier, these properties was well known at the time of the Romans. In fact, Seneca, in his Questions About Nature, writes the volcanic ash from Puteoli, so this town in southern Italy, becomes rocks when it touches water. So they knew about this reaction. They didn't know the type of reaction, they didn't know the minerals that this reaction was going to form, they didn't know the factors that were affecting this reaction, but they were keen observers and they knew that by mixing these two, actually they end up with material with exceptional properties. And so because of that, the Romans, Romans were used to export the volcanic ash throughout the Mediterranean. In fact, many ports in Cyprus, Caesarea, and also Alexandria in Egypt are made by using the same volcanic ash from Puteoli. So I mentioned that by mixing volcanic ash and lime, the reaction forms this family of calcium aluminum silicate hydrates known as CASH, and they're a big family of crystals. And the most important thing or take-home message that I like you to retain here is that this reaction provides minerals that crystallize in the form of fibers. So here there are some names, ettringite, tobemerite. It's not a big deal remembering this name, but the most important things are the fibers that they form. They form in alkaline environments, so you need high potassium and sodium environments, so pH higher than 10, and most importantly, you need very hydration conditions. So both are conditions that are clearly not lacking in a caldera. Why fibers are important for materials, and in this case, rocks? Well, the first to discover or to describe the effect of fibers in materials was actually Galileo. In fact, in discussing in one of his book, The Dialogues Concerning the Two Sciences, in discussing the strength of a rope, he was right to emphasize that to suggest that both the twist and the intertwine of the fibers may play a role which provides strength to the materials and also, in this case, we will see to rocks. In fact, nowadays, engineers are used to fiber reinforce their concrete to make it stronger. In fact, here I'm showing a plot showing stress as a function of strain of cementitious mortars that has been the properties have been enhanced by adding carbon fibers in a different percentage. What we see here, the higher is the percentage of the fibers that have been added to the material, the higher is the stress that the material is able to withstand. And also, most importantly, is that the stress-strain relationship also changed the shape. We go from peaked, to materials that are that show a brittle type of behavior to materials that show more plastic deformation, just because this curve is this peak is higher. So, with all this in mind, so the presence of fibers, the effect that they have in the strength, and the type of reaction that from which these fibers can originate, let's enter in the core of this talk. So we are in southern Italy. We are in the Gulf of Naples, and this is the Mount Vesuvius here, and this is the caldera we will be talking today. So this is the town. It's called Pozzuoli. It's basically the Roman town Puteoli. So as you can see here, there are many craters that testify the presence of past eruptions. But most importantly, what I want to point out here, I don't know if you are able to see, underneath the sea level, you see some structures. This structure is basically the ancient Roman port. There is an ancient, I mentioned that this town was the port of entry, was very famous for commercial exchange between the Middle East and the Roman Empire in Italy. And right now, this port is underneath the sea level. Why is underneath the sea level? Well, because since Roman time, and probably even before, and continues nowadays, the town experienced uplift and subsidence over time. And so here you can see this plot that shows the vertical displacement, so really the uplift and subsidence, over time since, you know, Roman time. This is very unique. It's a very unique place because nowadays the way geophysicists measure ground deformation is by using GPS, continuous GPS recording, and antennas that track the uplifts of subsidence. So how is it possible we have this long-term record of data? Well, the answer comes from these three columns that you probably have seen from the cover of Science. These columns are columns or marbles, and they are the columns of a Roman marketplace. As you can see here, there is a darker band, here the columns are pierced by the presence of marine bivalves that are used to live and were used to live at the sea level. So scientists, by connecting, by dating the shells that remain post-mortem within these holes to the height of the holes, over time they have been able to track the variation of uplift subsidence of this place. And this is just a more recent picture. So we have seen that the place has been subsidence since Roman time. This is the eruption of Mount Vesuvius in 1779 AD. And then at some point here, there's been an inversion. And here there's been a big eruption in 1538. And then we arrive to modern times and to this last seismic crisis. Fortunately, there were no eruptions, but the town has experienced large deformation. And you can see here from this picture, this is a picture from 1980, 82. So the first thing that is a fact that this is a coastal town is the dock. Clearly, the just to give you an idea how much is the uplift, the ship could not dock. And so there are different levels of docks that have been built over time. So what happened in 1982? The town has been started to uplift at an alarming rate. I like to show here is that the uplift events compared the deformation or the uplift in this town to other calderas like Yellowstone and Long Valley, the deformation here is really huge. We are talking about 1.8 meters in about 2 years. But then the other interesting point to make is that despite the large uplift, the release of the strain in terms of seismicity is delayed, which means that seismicity started once the town and so the rocks deformed by 80 or 70 centimeters. So from my point of view, and from a rock physics point of view, my question has been always, what type of rocks we have in the subsurface that are able to withstand such high strain and also have some high strength because the seismicity is delayed? In other words, what kind of rocks can accommodate such high strain without releasing sooner the stored rift deformation through fracturing and cracking, which means releasing, generating micro earthquakes. So the study really started by reconstructing the structure of the caldera by using seismic tomography. And we did that by using the micro earthquakes that occur in so the micro earthquakes and the location of micro earthquakes are these points here. And these figures, I'm showing a vertical slice of the 3D reconstruction, the tomographic reconstruction of the caldera. The colors refer to the velocity of the P waves. So red colors or hot colors refer to low velocity, and cooler colors, so going towards green or blue refer to high P wave velocity. What I want to emphasize here is that if we look at the picture, there is a seismic horizon that bends upward in a sort of arch shape, and the maximum bending occurs underneath the area that experiences the larger deformation. You have to think that the deformation in this area really resemble a very narrow bell shape. So it's very the uplift is really concentrated at the center of the caldera. The other thing that I want to point out is that the whole seismicity, the seismogenic area, so the area that generates the micro earthquakes, occur underneath this layer. So I've been curious to understand what's the material constituted this layer, and most importantly, what's the possible mechanism that generates the microseismicity. So as a first thing, I extracted the variation of velocity as a function of depth at the center of the caldera. So this is the plot that you are seeing on your right. The gray line is the variation of Vp as a function of depth. The red line is the variation of Vs as a function of depth. And one thing that is important to mention here is that normally velocity should increase with depth because we have compaction, porosity decreases, and velocity of the elastic wave goes up. So we shouldn't really expect reversals. But we have reversals, meaning that velocity decreases a certain depth. And so generally speaking, velocity reversals always, they also can can be due to variation in type of rocks, but this is not the case because we analyze, as I will see, the type of rocks. So the other reason why we can have reversals is just the presence of an anomalous compaction trend due to mechanism that prevents effective stress from increasing as it should due to normal lithostatic pressure condition. In other words, by going down, there might be fluids that exert poor fluid pressure and prevent the rock from compacting. So you have a rock here that is more porous than the rock that is on the surface. And this prevention in compacting the rock is due to poor fluid pressure. But in order to have a poor pressure build up, we need a lid, because it's like a pot on the stove that is boiling. If we don't have the lid, there is no pressure build up. So that's why I start to analyze the rocks from this layer. We were fortunate enough that in 1980, 12 deep wells were drilled in the area. And so we have been analyzing the rocks as a function of depth that were extracted from this well. So we focused the attention on this layer that from the tomography is lying between 1 kilometers, 1.5, maximum 1.8 kilometers. And we extracted cores, we obtained the cores from the wells that I'm showing here. The first analysis that we did was the composition. So here we see a plot, aluminum oxide plus silica as a function of calcium oxide and magnesium oxide. All the composition that comes from these rocks are shown in blue, dark blue diamonds. So we have a siliceous, aluminous siliceous material that is composing this rock. And here in light blue, I'm showing the volcanic ash, the famous pozzolanic ash that I showed at the very beginning. So the composition is very similar. And this was not really surprising because these rocks come from the same caldera. So we had to have the same composition. But then we start analyzing the microstructure of this rock. So what I'm showing here are scanning electron microscope images. So we have here a layer that is constituted by very fine matrix. You can see here the scale. And then there is this vogular moldic porosity, so pores that are formed by the dissolution of material here that you see in lighter material, which we analyze by doing EDS, which is calcium, either calcium oxide or carbonate, calcium-rich or magnesium-rich carbonates. But then the most important thing that attracted our attention was the fact that by zooming in more into the matrix composing this layer, we start to see some fibers, so fibrous materials. And they are very pervasive, as you can see here. They are. We went to Chicago to the APSL facility at the synchrotron just to understand the mineral composition of these fibers and also the amount. So we have about 12% of this fibrous material, and the mineral composition that you can see, you can see the fibers here. The mineral composition of these fibers were the same fibers that I showed at the very beginning, the ettringite and tobemorite. So at the very beginning, I didn't even know that those fibers were forming by mixing lime water with the volcanic ash. So the first thing that we did was measuring the properties of this material, because this was really the reason why we got interested in this project to begin with. So we measured the PNS wave velocity and the elastic moduli that you get, so the bulk and the shear modulus as a function of stress. We also measured the compressive strength of this material, and we also measured the permeability as a function of stress. For the sake of time, I'm not going to focus on permeability, but I have to, one thing that I can say, that this rock, this lead that I'm referring to, is really impermeable. We are talking about 30 microdarcy to 2 microdarcy. So it's not a rock that favor the passage of fluids. Here I'm showing a plot that shows the variation Young modulus as a function of bulk modulus. What we can see here is that the rocks from this lead, from this cap rock, from this impermeable layer, has very high bulk modulus and Young modulus, which is higher with respect to other volcanic tuff that outcrop in the area, the yellow tuff and the gray tuff. But most importantly, at least more interesting here I'm overlaying the shear modulus as a function of Young modulus. And we can see here that it's particularly interesting is the enhancement of the shear modulus of the cap rock samples, which reaches values that are very similar to the bulk modulus. So in other words, while going down, there is an enhancement of the shear resistance of this rock. And in general, every time you have, at least this is our interpretation, every time you have fibrous and intertwined fibers, the resistance to the shear stress is much higher. So the other type of analysis that we did, we measure stress and strain of these rocks. And so here is the stress and strain of the yellow tuff that I took from the literature, and this is the stress and strain of the cap rock. So you can see that the failure point or the stress that these rocks can withstand is much higher to the tuff counterpart. And finally, here, I'm in this busy plot, I'm just recasting the compressive strength as a function of Young modulus. So here are the values from the cap rock. Here is, in cyan, is the compressive strength and Young modulus for Roman concrete. Roman concrete is very durable, but it's not very, it doesn't withstand high, it doesn't show high strength. And here in black, it's pozzolanic concrete that is made by engineers that is cured over time under hydrated conditions. For example, in our lab right now, we are making, in order to understand the mechanism, we are making or mixing the volcanic ash with lime, and we are curing the rock in a steam chamber just to replicate or possibly replicate the condition we may have in a caldera. Because let's remember, those fibers, in order to thrive, they really need hydrated conditions. So on one hand, we have the volcanic ash. On the other hand, we have a rock that is an impermeable. It shows fibers, the presence of fibers, and minerals that come from the mixing of lime with the volcanic ash. But there was still a question mark, where does the lime come from? So we went down deeper, and we analyzed the rock from the basement. These rocks here are called metacarbonate by geologists, or calc silicates. And I just explained earlier in the undergrad class, the metacarbonate or calc silicate rocks, basically it's a carbonate rock that it's very impure, has a lot of silica, and so it's not just a rock that is constituted by calcium carbonate, but has a lot of silica and also other minerals. So then we analyzed the microstructure of these rocks, and it was interesting to see that between the grains of calcite, which are typical of a carbonate rock, and also the matrix of quartz here, in between, we found minerals that had this shape of needles. We analyzed the needles, and we discovered that these minerals are actinolite. And I will tell you in a moment how actinolite forms. But most interesting, the other interesting thing was that between these fibers, we had these spherules that we analyzed by using EDS. Those are spherules of pure carbon, and so those are spherules of graphite. So the question was how the, unfortunately, it was not, they were not diamonds, but. So the question was, where does the how do these minerals form? And so we had, and generally, the clue was that generally actinolite is a mineral that forms in a very specific environment. They don't form everywhere, and so they form as a result of decarbonation reaction. I'm not going to annoy you too much with the decarbonation reaction, but it's a very simple reaction. Decarbonation reaction is a reaction that occurs every time you expose a carbonate rock to high temperature. So you can see here the temperature that is required depending on the pressure at which you expose your rock. So decarbonation reaction is the first reaction, the first step for calcination. So where does the lime come from? Normally, the lime is produced by taking carbonate rocks at very high temperature, normally 1,200 degrees Celsius, and that's how it's the industrial process to obtain the lime. It's really a high energy or intensive energy process. But if in nature, if you have liquids or fluids, the temperature can be, and depending on the pressure, can be as low as 350 degrees Celsius. I didn't mention that in that caldera, at 3 kilometers, 3.5 kilometers depth, we have 400 degrees Celsius. So this is the reaction. From a calcium carbonate rocks, in presence of silica-rich fluid, so it's an aqueous solution here, you get a silicate of calcium, the famous needles, and then the reaction releases CO2. So it's very important as a mechanism that releases CO2 and also possibly pore pressure buildup. I like to point out two things. This is the simplest reaction that may occur in a very pure carbonates. But we know that nature is never pure. And so actinolite, the famous needles that we saw, the presence of iron that could come from the fluids, the geothermal fluid, can replace the calcium. And so this is the longest formula. But again, those are needles that comes from the decarbonation. The other thing that I want to point out, that this is a reversible reaction. It can go to the right, can go to the left. So when we have the more CO2 forms, so we are moving to the right of this reaction, then at some point the reaction stops, it reaches an equilibrium. If we have an overabundance of CO2, the reaction goes back. And so we have the opposite of decarbonation, which is carbonation. But then, if fluids are introduced in the system, what the fluids do, they dilute the CO2. So they promote more reaction that form CO2. So again, abundance of CO2, go back to calcium carbonate. Depleting of CO2 because dilution or new fluids coming into the system, new CO2 forms. And this is very important to understand maybe the physical chemical process that may occur in this caldera. So the idea that we proposed was clearly this is a geothermal system, has as a magma chamber somewhere, and so by providing heat to the carbonate rocks are decarbonating and releasing CO2. Once the CO2, so the CO2 forms here and the famous actinolite, the needles forms. Once the CO2 forms, a new reaction may set. The CO2 may recombine with the calcium carbonate. It combines with the hydrogen that comes from the splitting of the water at high temperature to form the graphite, the methane, which we always have in a volcanic environment, and then the calcium hydroxide, also known as portlandite or lime. So we think that this is the source of lime. Clearly, this is an hypothesis. We have some evidence because the minerals, but then I wanted to understand more if there were other observations. I want just to mention. So what may happen is that this lime then can be brought up at shallower depth until the cap rock is found. And so at that point, the presence of lime, of these fluids rich in lime, can induce this pozzolanic activity, and so what we call the cement-making stage, and so forming these intertwined fibers that we have seen in the caldera. So everything seems to work fine, but clearly we wanted to have more evidence. So I found this beautiful book, which is from Charles Babbage in 1837. Babbage is the same Babbage that is best remembered for originating the concept of computers, so programmable computer. But he was very interested in this region, and so he wrote actually a paper that was submitted to the Geological Society of London. This is the columns that you have seen at the very beginning in this Roman marketplace. It's called temple because at the very beginning the archaeologists thought was a temple, but then later on they discover was actually a marketplace. What Babbage noticed, he made two observations. The first observation was really the fact that the column were pierced by this hole. So it was really his observation. Then later on the scientists connected the dots between dating the shells and the height. But then there is another important observation he made that has been for a long time neglected. He noticed that the lower portion of this columns was basically uninjured and smooth, as there were something that over time had preserved the columns from being pierced by these bivalves. In fact, for a long time, this has been a marketplace that has been excavated for a long time. Just the tip of the three columns where people were only able to see the tips of the two columns. So He saw that along the columns there were incrustation of material, and also the perimeteral walls of this structure had steel, the material. And so he analyzed the material. And this was shown by another beautiful book, which is by Charles Lyell, which is really the father of the modern geology. So in his Principle of Geology, Charles Lyell dedicates an entire chapter to this phenomenon. And so he says that Mr. Babbage, after examining the incrustation along the columns, has showed that the composition of this was carbonate of lime. So somehow, by going down, because it, within what I didn't mention, sorry, which is here, within this Roman market, there are hot springs that are present, and so much likely this material had been deposited over time by the spring, the water, the hot spring water. So this is what we have been working on, and now we open a new chapter. We want to understand what are the processes that may undermine the cap rock. And so this is our current hypothesis and what we are working on. As I mentioned at the beginning, if new fluids enter the system, could be any fluids. Could be fluids from the deeper magma chamber, or this is a coastal town, seawater can enter. And we know that the composition of the reservoir here is highly saline. So if new fluids come into, we say that the fluids dilute the CO2 and promote more reaction, and so the decarbonation. In turn, the CO2 creates more methane and more also hydrogen. And so clearly there might be a region or a phase where we may have pore pressure buildup that we saw from the reversal at the very beginning. But I still believe that there might be another mechanism because, again, the seismicity is really delayed because of the fibers. And so what we are working right now is the carbonation of the cap rock. This is a well-known process that occurs in concrete. The presence of CO2 in the atmosphere actually carbonates. So the presence of CO2 makes those fibers and transform those fibers back into carbonate rocks. And so that may affect the strength, beside the fact that it also induces cracking. So this is a well-known phenomenon in the engineering community. I just want to see if by exposing these rocks from the cap rock, we may induce the same carbonation process, and then see how the elastic properties and strength can be affected. So to conclude my talk today, I show that the presence of natural fibrous rock is really, in my opinion, really fascinating, because it really highlights the presence of a physical chemical process. So it's not just fluid exerting stresses like pore fluid pressure, but also fluid that can interact with the materials, the rocks in the subsurface, and so affecting their strength. I want to also mention that this ashes, and so this pozzolanic nature of the ashes, is not something that we found only in this specific caldera in southern Italy. Because here I put a table, so this is the volcanic ash from the specific place that I showed today. Then we have also the volcanic ash from Santorini, another explosive caldera, and the composition is the same. And then we have these two places. One is Iwo Jima. And Iwo Jima, in 1994, the Japanese were quick to discover that the volcanic ash, which was abundant, is still abundant on the island, was used to create concrete of superior quality. So over time, the Romans, the Greek before the Romans, and then the Japanese used the volcanic ash to make their concrete. So then clearly, it remains to be seen if you need not only this volcanic ash, you need also a source of lime. So every time calderas are in places on system carbonate rocks that may decarbonate because of high temperature, it may be possible to induce the same reaction. So that's, to me, it opens new ways of thinking of pore pressure buildups and deformation in volcanic area. From a mechanical perspective, I found this very fascinating because for a long time, as a rock physicist, we always been thinking of rocks as a granular material. But we can have fibers, and so the strength of fibrous minerals, completely natural, and so the strength and the ability to these rocks to resist to stress, and so to have a high, an enhanced strength can be very important for microseismicity. Clearly, it still remains to be seen how the presence of CO2 can really contribute to undermine the presence of the properties of the cap rock. And I like to finish this talk by quoting this professor, Leslie Strubel, who is professor in the civil and environmental engineering at University of Urbana-Champaign. She always mentioned, it won't matter how well the structure was designed, if the concrete crumbles and the steel rust, it's all about chemistry. Well, from what I showed today, clearly also rocks may experience these processes that may alter the physical properties and also the mechanical properties. And so I think in the years to come, it's very important for rock physics to go to the next level. It's not just the physics of the rock, but also how fluids can interact with the rock due to chemical interactions. And with that, I will be happy to take any question you may have. Thank you. Lady first.
In one of the major graphics you have, you've got CO2 pressure and methane pressure, and the cap rock is rising.
Yeah, this is an hypothesis.
Yeah.
So just.
Do you think that might eventually erupt again as a volcano or a volcanic type of eruption?
Well, as I mentioned at the very beginning, when I showed the vertical displacement as a function of time, we have evidence in the past of volcanic eruption, and again, and that area never experienced lava type of volcanic eruption, always ash type of eruption. So I think if the pressure is enough to crack that cap rock, suddenly and also with greater stress, clearly an eruption may occur. Over time, I didn't mention, I was born and raised in that region, and so we have been evacuated during the last crisis for 2 years. After the port, the town uplifted about 2 meters, clearly the Vesuvian Observatory there thought that an eruption was about to occur. So we have been evacuated. We stayed, we lived for about 2 years away. And fortunately, no eruption occurred, but just a very continuous seismic crisis. As I mentioned, after the uplift reached 80, 90 centimeters, then a continuous seismic activity started. We had like 600 microearthquakes in one night. Mm-hmm. So you really need to have, you reach a critical point. And probably that was good to release the accumulated stress over time, but the rock was more creeping because the magnitude of micro earthquakes is not that big. We are talking about 3.8. The maximum was 4. They are very shallow, as I mentioned from the tomography. We are talking about 2.5, and so they were definitely felt. So going back to your question, both scenarios can occur if I believe that the uplift subsidence, because a magma chamber has not been found yet at that depth where the micro earthquakes occur, I still believe that the main source generating the micro seismicity is just pore pressure built up due to the presence of this lead. So it's a curse, and it's a good thing, but also a curse that this lead has exceptional properties, because if the lead would fail sooner, clearly there might be no such pore pressure to build up over time. So and probably we wouldn't have that magnitude of uplift, which generally is recorded in that town and then Iwo Jima. Those are the two places that showing an exceptional uplift. The other calderas like Long Valley or Yellowstone, the type of uplift is just a few centimeters, yeah. And the rock promptly break.
Well, that's quite dramatic. Thank you so much for your talk.
Thank you. I would love to hear more.
So Portland cement concrete, you don't even talk about that.
Yeah, this is a good point. I've been working a lot with Paolo Montero at UC Berkeley. And I do know, coming from a different perspective, that the cache material that forms mostly a gel type of material. So the fibers are not well found, or they are protofibers, really small. And this rock, the fibers are more pervasive. You know, we're talking about 12% of this stuff. I'm not sure how much of that you may have in a concrete, but I think that, and probably that's also an interesting thing to see, how the hydration, a continuous hydration in the caldera, the presence of certain temperature, at that specific depth, because we don't find, even though the composition of the volcanic cache is the same throughout the caldera, but the only place where we found those fibers is only at that depth. So I don't know if temperature plays a role. And also I think it's really, I'm learning that it's really the aspect ratio of those fibers. So it's possible that nature does a good job and would be somehow. And so it would be interesting to understand what makes those fibers thrive that way.
Well, you said you did triaxial testing with some simulated materials. Did you find any difference?
You mean the one that we create in the labs? Yeah, this is that's how I know that by just mixing and even curing the material we cured the pozzolani cache with the lime for 28 days, and still we see very tiny, tiny fibers, and the strength, it's not the one that we see there. But then I start thinking, in order to make those rocks, we use the same recipe that Vitruvius provide us. But then I start thinking, a cap rock, I don't know how much lime. Clearly, there is geological time that the cap rock has experienced. So I don't know if the amount of lime that is required in the cap rock to make those fibers is the same lime, the same amount that we use, you know, from the recipe of Roman concrete. So I would be interesting to see if by decreasing the amount of lime, but then keeping constant the temperature at which, and then the curing time, which clearly we cannot simulate in the lab because we cannot simulate geological times. Clearly, as I mentioned, there is something in the caldera that makes those fibers thrive, and we cannot replicate that. You're welcome.
Mechanism might be for the subsidence and then the healing that you talked about.
Yeah, that's something interesting, and we didn't. This is just an hypothesis. I can tell that every time there is deformation, so uplift, the subsidence. So right now, for example, in 1982, the region has uplift 1.8 meters, and we recovered only 30 centimeters. So there is a slow subsidence, which probably is due to just compaction. Because one thing that I didn't mention, if you walk through the region and the town, you see fumaroles coming or getting, so gases getting out. But then at some point, they disappear. And many people think it's good because clearly it's not, you don't have any evidence of process in subsurface. But I also think that might be, you know, if the caprock is healing, you're just creating this lead. And so then the fumaroles start to be seen after the microseismicity starts. So if we want to think that the uplift and subsidence is due to pore pressure buildup and then clearly gases are released, fluids and even steam is released, it takes time to go back. It never recover the deformation. And then meanwhile, you know, there are other sign of uplift. So it's more adding up over time than, you know, recovering the deformation. In fact, the Roman port is still underwater. It never came out. No, this was a program that started in 1980s, and then in 1982, the town has experienced uplift and then seismic activity. So there was a big discussion if that was provoked, you know, by withdrawing fluids and so letting seawater entering the system that could have triggered something. So the project was abandoned for two reasons. First, because there was seismic activity, but then from it was not economically viable from you know, the point of exploiting the resource, because the permeability of those rocks is really low, and so unless you frack, which is not something to clearly people doesn't like to think that way, because it's already a region that experienced seismic activity. So after that, you know, after the uplift started, I have the logs, which unfortunately is just BP logs. There was, at that time, there was no continuous recording of S wave velocity. And we also have temperature. And also, for example, the temperature, that's the other thing why I don't think there was a magma intrusion, because the temperature was quite constant over time. Those wells were being recorded across the period of the deformation, and then after that was abandoned. So I guess right now the wells are just clogged. And,
so far no Italian or scientist has been sued over this project?
No, no. But I want to mention, you know, this is something that is going on, but the fact that the prosecutors decide to sue the scientists was not for scientific reasons, was more related to something else. So it was not the fact, and this was has been clarified later on, was not for the inability to predict an earthquake. It was something else.
All right, can we thank our speakers?